Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. Today, I am very delighted to welcome the very wonderful Bea from Bea's Birth and Boobs, who is a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor like me, but she was also a breastfeeding counsellor and infant feeding specialist, and she works along the NHS community as an infant feeding support worker as well. So she's really passionate about birth and infant feeding. And today we're going to be talking about birth and breastfeeding or infant feeding. So welcome, Bea.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited to talk.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to you too. And I think it's a really important topic because it's something that I think people do a lot of prep about their birth. And I think they quite often forget to prep for their postpartum period and feeding their baby afterwards. And a lot of people don't realize there's a link between your birth and feeding afterwards, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is one of those things that, you know, when you're going through the sort of side effects of things that can happen in your birth, you almost forget about actually what happens afterwards and whether they can impact the feeding experience for you. So actually knowing about that, particularly beforehand, is really, really helpful because it can just help you make that informed decision. But even if you do come across any of these things, it means that you know what's happened and it's not just like, oh God, I'm terrible at this, it's my fault. You know, it's really important. They are so interlinked. It is not just two separate things. They are incredibly, incredibly interlinked. And it comes straight after the other. You know, it doesn't just happen birth and then we've got a period of time until you start feeding. It is literally an immediate afterwards.
Yeah. And actually really important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not straight away. Okay, so we've said there is a definite link between your birth and your feeding experience afterwards. So do you want to talk a little bit about some of the things that can impact infant feeding after you've given birth?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to do a quick caveat at the start that I am absolutely, there's no judgment here. I am not saying that everyone has to have an unmedicated birth at home. You know, it's everyone has their own individual situations. But it's just about being aware of the possibilities, aware of the, you know, side effects, things that can happen with these things, particularly before having a baby. You know, if you're making these decisions beforehand, you can kind of go into the process and go, okay, well, that is a possibility. However, it also means that afterwards, you're not thinking that I've made a, you know, I'm doing terrible at breastfeeding, it's my fault. But it also means that you can target what's happened and you can tackle it. And it's just about giving informed consent, because if you don't know that any of these things actually can impact feeding, you can't really give that informed consent. And I'm really big on actually giving genuine informed consent. And I think a good place to start is a really simple one of pain relief. You know, many people do want to accept pain relief during their birth, and that is absolutely fine. But they can have implications on your feeding experiences. So, particularly pethidine, dimorphine and epidural. They're kind of, obviously, pethidine and dimorphine are fairly similar. Epidural is a little bit different, but they do have quite similar sort of effects on the baby in terms of, it means they have quite difficulty coordinating to be able to latch. So some babies, if you have had that type of pain relief, it can be quite difficult for the baby to actually be able to latch on. It almost seems like they're trying to find it, but they're just not able to. They're not able to open their mouth. They're struggling to actually figure out their muscles to actually be able to latch on. And this can actually happen for quite a while, not just right at the beginning, but it can happen for up to 2 weeks. So it's not something that can happen right at the start. So it's really kind of knowing that that is a possibility and kind of persevering through that as well. Babies can be very sleepy with these as well. And this is particularly my experience with my first. I had dimorphine during my labour. And when she was born, she was really, really sleepy. She just would not, she wasn't interested in feeding for at least probably about 7, 8 hours. I'm incredibly lucky that the midwives seemed to almost kind of lucky, kind of not, because 7, 8 hours without a feed is a bit of a concern. It is a bit of a red flag, and they probably should have encouraged things a little bit sooner, but they didn't push anything on me. But you would probably find that if your baby hasn't fed for that amount of time after birth, they probably would be trying to encourage you to either hand express or give some formula, because they do get really, really sleepy. So they can, it crosses through to the placenta. So that's why during the birth, they want to do a vaginal examination to actually find out how dilated you are, because if you are maybe further along, they may sort of advise against having pethidine or dimorphine because of that effect, that actually it may still be there in the baby. It's not going to wear off in time, so they will still be quite sleepy. So that is quite common, but you can do things to help. And I really wanted to make sure that I mentioned things that actually you can do to help in these situations. And it's not just like, well, if I've had pethidine, dimorphine or an epidural, I'm not going to feed my baby. You know, this is just things that happen and I'm fucked basically. Skin to skin is honestly the best possible thing. And you will see a very similar theme throughout everything that I talk about in terms of just getting skin to skin. And by skin to skin, I don't just mean quick 10 minutes here and there. I mean, literally putting you and baby in skin to skin contact and staying there for hours and hours upon end, because it triggers the rooting reflex. It helps to start increasing your oxytocin, which is going to get milk flowing. So it really does help to actually start the process of things. So staying in that skin to skin contact, you know, being in that laid back breastfeeding position can again help baby to actually start that rooting reflex, offering the breast really frequently, even if they are very sleepy, even if they are struggling to coordinate. The more that you offer, the kind of better things get, because you're able to both get that practice in. And if baby really is not taking to the breast at all and just refusing completely, making sure that you're keeping that milk supply going, keeping that milk flowing by hand expressing, and you can syringe feed to your baby. A baby at, you know, at birth needs tiny, tiny amounts, you know, literally probably a teaspoon of colostrum for each feed. So they don't need huge amounts at all, but keeping that milk flow going, keeping that stimulation and allowing baby to actually have that colostrum off a spoon, off a syringe, it will help to keep them interested. And sometimes some babies, all they need is actually that little bit of boost of colostrum and they actually start being a bit more interested and start feeding at the breast. But yeah, pain relief is definitely one that is a really common one that people will come across, because people will want to have pain relief or want to know the options of pain relief, and just knowing how to actually combat that is just something that's really important when it comes to feeding. If feeding is something, you know, breastfeeding is something that you are quite interested in wanting to actually do, just having that awareness of how things can, you know, implicate your feeding experiences is really, really important.
Yeah. And I feel like when people are offered drugs in labor, I don't feel like the impact is really discussed. You know, I had with my first birth, and I've mentioned this before, I had pethidine, I had an epidural, I was also induced, so I had synthetic oxytocin. We'll talk about that next, maybe.
Yeah.
But all of these things impact breastfeeding afterwards. And I was the same, you know, my daughter was really sleepy. I had a really long labor, so I was exhausted. She was exhausted. We both slept through the, you know, I think she was born at 1:30 in the morning. And when they did a shift change at 7 in the morning, they came round and were like, how's baby feeding? And we'd both slept the entire time and hadn't woken up. And I got really told off by the midwives, which I thought was really inappropriate, because first time mum, I didn't know I was supposed to wake her every 3 hours. No one told me. And she didn't wake up for a feed because she was really, really drowsy. And I never managed to breastfeed my eldest because I didn't get the support. I found it really hard. You know, she wouldn't latch. And I think that's, you know, in hindsight, potentially, I don't know, potentially, if I had have known the impacts of the pethidine and the epidural and the induction, I maybe would have gone down a different route. But I feel like it's important that you proactively go and prep and you know, understand the effects of some of these drugs. And also I think it's a disservice by the NHS to not be properly informing people antenatally or before they're administering the drugs, the impact that it potentially could have.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the, when I was offered the dimorphine, it just came across as a, let's help you get a little bit of sleep. There was absolutely no discussion on that it could make babies sleepy as well. And it's just not having that sort of adequate support and stuff and people explaining the possible implications of it and not knowing afterwards. I kind of thought, you think it's your fault, you know, you're going, oh my gosh, my baby's not waking up, they're not feeding, I'm doing something wrong. Whereas actually, if you know that it's possibly just the medication that you had, you can kind of come to terms with that a lot more and go, okay, well, it's for that reason. I accepted it because I really did need it and that's absolutely okay. But it means that I'm not doing something wrong here. It's not me, it's the medication that's causing this. And I just think that's so important because people place so much blame on themselves in the birth and the breastfeeding process. And I just think we need to take that blame away and know that it isn't you, it's not you that's doing something wrong, it's just what's happened due to this.
Yeah. Do you want to cover induction next?
Oh yes.
Like I feel like we could talk for an hour on induction, but
oh my gosh, yeah. I'm gonna have to try and keep myself short on this because I could go on forever. In my course, we go on about induction for at least an hour, and I'm like, right, we need to slow down on the time. But induction, I've kind of separated into two possible sections. So the first one is that actually a baby is born too early, because with induction, you know, it happens at various points in time. It can happen at, you know, a really early point, actually, but it's commonly around, you know, 37, 38 weeks, sometimes that little bit later, 39 weeks. But we don't know the gestation that the baby actually is. We don't know if that baby would actually come at maybe 39 weeks. Maybe they could come at 42 weeks. So we've got the risk of the baby being born a lot earlier than they were planning to come. And this can create quite a few issues with breastfeeding because they're coming at a point where actually they look like they are term, you know, and to us, well, the 37 weeks, they're term, they're, you know, a decent size. They look like they're physically okay, but we commonly call them the great pretenders because they go to the breast, but they actually don't really do much. They're really not interested. They don't actually feed. They don't do any active sucking and swallowing. They latch on and they just kind of fall asleep really quickly. And they're quite slow to get going because we call these sort of like the early term, early term, late preterm births are really common for this kind of behavior. They just really struggle to get going and they just take that much longer to actually get to the point of feeding effectively. So it's really normal that they literally will latch on and just kind of sit there, do nothing. So you kind of go, oh great, they're on, they're feeding, whereas actually they're not really doing all that much. So it can take a lot of sort of determination, a lot of perseverance to push through this. And again, skin to skin, staying that skin to skin contact all the time, offering the feeds really, really frequently. And something that I talk really often about with people all the time with feeding is doing breast compressions. So literally taking a hand and like squeezing right at the top of the breast to almost push some of the breast milk out from the breast into baby's mouth to kind of give them a bit of a helping hand. Because if they're latching on, that's half of the battle. But if you can make it a little bit easier for them to actually start sucking, start swallowing, they can start doing that themselves. But we sometimes need to give them a bit of a helping hand with it. And that's absolutely okay. I think some professionals are really sort of against that. And it's like, well, don't, you know, they need to do it themselves. But if they're not doing themselves, we have to do something to actually help them. So doing those breast compressions. And if you know that you're going to be induced, regardless of when it is, even if it's at 41 weeks, even if it's at 42 weeks, again, we don't know when that baby would naturally decide to come. Do some antenatal colostrum harvesting. So start hand expressing and storing your colostrum in some syringes because then you've got a little bit of extra there. So you're not stressing if that baby is born and actually just isn't interested, isn't actually feeding effectively. You don't need to suddenly stress and go, well, now I need to hand express. Oh no, I don't know how to hand express. You're trying to hand express when you're feeling stressed, which is just not going to help things at all. So actually having that colostrum stored is kind of that little bit of a backup just in case, and then you can start hand expressing as well. Don't just give those syringes and leave your breast to do nothing. You do still need to start stimulating. But also it means that you need to carefully consider the offer of induction, because it can implicate things with your feeding. It's not just that your baby is coming nice and early. Yeah, that's great, wonderful. You know, we're getting to meet your baby a few weeks sooner than you expected. There are risks associated with that. And especially if breastfeeding is something that you're really, really keen to do, this could be something that actually helps make the decision for your induction process. You know, really, really carefully consider it. Look at all the statistics, look at the evidence, use your brain, like we talk about in hypnobirthing classes, to actually help you make that decision rather than just going along with what is suggested because it is policy, because it's guideline. Make the right choice for you. And I'm not saying carefully consider it as in decline the induction, because it absolutely might be medically necessary for you, but it's about just thinking about it a little bit more. Just take some thought process, take 24 hours to sit on the decision before you actually make that choice, so that you can figure out, actually, is it maybe the right choice for me, or do I need to make a different decision? And that could be, you know, making the decision of just waiting. It could be making the decision of having a cesarean, but just sit on that decision a little bit more in terms of, you know, what can actually happen, so that you're making the choice as well. Yeah.
So what about the different methods of induction? Because obviously there are drugs involved with induction, and they can have an impact on the postnatal period as well, can't they, in feeding?
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly the what they call the drip commonly, or the syntocinon, basically. So synthetic oxytocin, that is done via a cannula. So you're getting IV fluids. And this can really, really impact things with feeding in two separate ways. So the first one is not very commonly known, is that it can actually inflate baby's birth weight. Yes. A little bit, because you're getting those IV fluids, they're getting them as well. And they can come out a little bit puffier. So they're actually heavier than what they were meant to be. And what this can have a massive impact on is around day five, the midwife will come and weigh baby. And it's very, very normal for babies to lose some of their birth weight. Up to around 10% is completely normal. But if you've had IV fluids where the baby is a little bit heavier than actually they were meant to be, they've then lost that fluid, then lost additional weight that they were going to anyway, perhaps that, you know, that drop in weight is going to be more than what it would have been. So maybe it's looking at, you know, 12, 13%, whereas actually it might have just been 8, 9%. And then that can cause lots of panic, lots of worry. Oh my goodness, your baby has lost too much weight. We need to get you on a very strict feeding plan. We need to be feeding this much, and then we need to get formula. And then that could obviously, you start topping up, that can have an impact on the breastfeeding process. And that is not something I'm going to go into detail right now, because again, the top ups can be a conversation in itself, but it can impact things because it looks like your baby has lost far, far too much weight. And you can request, if you do have any IV fluids at all, and that is the same thing for example, during my first labour, I had paracetamol through an IV fluid. So that could have impacted her birth weight, because that is still intravenous fluids that were given to me. You can ask 24 hours later for them to reweigh your baby so that it gets a bit of an idea, because suddenly, you know, they might have a massive drop 24 hours later. And if that's that massive drop, you can use that second wait at 24 hours to kind of gauge what's going on. So that on the day five weigh, if actually they use that wait at birth and that wait at 24 hours, you can kind of look, okay, well, what's actually happened? It might not be quite as panicky. And you can say, look, let's take a few days and we'll just see what happens. You know, it might be that actually everything is okay, but we're just panicking because of this weight loss. So let's just look at both of these weights, so you can request it. And it's not something that will just get given to you, you know, unless you specifically request it. if you don't request the second weigh-in at 24 hours, it won't get done at all, because it's not something that is common knowledge in health professionals. And I've spoken to many in the past and I've gone, oh, you know, spoken about this, and they've been absolutely none the wiser. They've said, I had no idea that that could even impact things at all. So it's not something that is, that they're aware about as well. And then it can also cause engorgement too, because again, intravenous fluids, what happens when your milk starts coming in is that when your breast starts to become really, really engorged, it's not just milk, it's other fluids as well that's all coming to the surface. So if you've had IV fluids, that can then impact how engorged you are. And that can be difficult to get baby to latch on. It can be uncomfortable. You can start expressing loads, and then that can create an oversupply. It's really difficult to latch a baby on to a really engorged breast as well. It's like having a fully inflated football and trying to tell them to latch on. It's just not going to happen. It's really, really hard. So that can sort of impact things around that. Again, that same sort of day five time. So you could have possible big weight loss and then engorgement. And you're going, oh my God, how on earth do I deal with all of this? This is a lot in one go. And you can feed frequently. You can do something called reverse pressure softening, which is basically you take like your thumb or your two fingers right next to your nipple, and you just press inwards towards your chest wall. And this kind of just temporarily pushes some of the breast milk back into your chest wall. So you're not overstimulating, you're not increasing your milk supply. It's just creating that, pushing it back just so you can get them soft enough to get baby to latch onto the breast. And cold compress, lymphatic breast massage, which is amazing in terms of engorgement and mastitis. Honestly, it's only recently that we've started to use cold compress and lymphatic breast massage for mastitis. And it is so nice. It's such a gentle, light touch rather than this really vigorous, you know, if you are engorged, your breast is very inflamed. Doing kneading to your breast is just going to create more inflammation and more pain. So this lymphatic breast massage is just really light. It's almost like stroking a cat, sort of light touch, and you're going just towards the back of your breast rather than towards your nipple. And don't panic if this kind of thing happens. Don't panic if the weight loss is over 10% if this happens, because you can look at things. If you have had intravenous fluid, so if you were induced on the drip, or not even induced, if you had the drip to speed things up during labor, you can look at things. And it's just maybe going, you know, you might forget at that 24 hours, you might have even been discharged from the hospital at 24 hours post birth. So it might be just about looking back and going, okay, well, I did actually have the drip during labor. So maybe we just need to reweigh maybe tomorrow and see where things are at. You know, maybe we need to look at things. Maybe we need to check the nappy output, because weight isn't just the only thing that matters. And we shouldn't just panic. We need to look at the bigger picture, and looking at actually the birth and whether you had those fluids is a really important part of it.
So what about the kind of chemical effects of the syntocinon? Because that also has an impact on feeding afterwards, doesn't it?
Yeah, the baby can definitely struggle in terms of, again, sleepiness and just not that interested in things at all. It impacts your hormone levels as well. So it could be that actually what happens when you're given syntocinon is that your natural oxytocin isn't actually happening. It kind of almost blocks that a little bit. So it means that actually you might not be producing that oxytocin, and we need oxytocin for the release of your breast milk. And if you've not got that happening, it just might be a little bit slower in terms of milk production because you haven't had that big surge of oxytocin during your labor. So again, skin to skin is a great way to overcome that because it just gives that massive boost of oxytocin afterwards. So staying in that skin to skin contact can just help to create that oxytocin rush as well.
How about C-section? Because there's quite a well-documented link between cesarean birth and struggling to breastfeed afterwards. So what's going on there? What's causing that problem?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of confusion with C-section and breastfeeding, because a lot of people say, well, if you have a cesarean, then it means that you're going to have a delay in milk production and your milk supply is going to be less. Excuse me. Whereas actually that's not exactly how it works, it's a bit more complicated than that. So the main thing really is pain for the mum, you know, for the birther. If she has had major abdominal surgery, there's going to be some pain there. So it can be quite uncomfortable for the birthing person to actually find a comfortable position to feed in. So it might be trying to figure out positions that is actually a bit more comfortable. And you might end up trying to hold the baby in a bit of a funny position because you're trying to avoid that cesarean scar. Again, the anesthesia can impact baby because it can mean that they are tired, they struggle to coordinate. You can absolutely breastfeed after having a C-section under general anaesthetic. It is absolutely safe. As soon as you are awake and alert, you can absolutely try to breastfeed. It doesn't impact things at all in terms of that, but it might just mean that because, again, it's crossing through to the placenta, and if you're having a cesarean, you're having either an epidural or a spinal block. So again, it's the same sort of things. A baby might be struggling to coordinate with their latch because of that medication. So it's more that is kind of what happens. It might mean that if you have a cesarean, you might not have that immediate skin to skin or immediately feeding your baby. Now, you absolutely can have immediate skin to skin during a cesarean, but some places will try and sort of push against that. So you kind of have to be a bit very firm and know I'm getting immediate skin to skin during my cesarean, but it'll be like, oh, well, this is not what we do in this hospital. No, you can do it. You can absolutely do it. So sometimes that can cause a delay in like that first feed or getting that immediate skin to skin, and you don't get that. That can cause a delay in things as well. So it just means that you're kind of like almost playing catch up with feeding if you don't get that immediate stuff. It doesn't mean that it's going to go all terribly. You can, you know, get skin to skin as soon as you possibly can. You know, it does not mean that that's it. What can happen as well is that babies get a bit of mucus on their chests during a cesarean, during a vaginal birth. They're coming through the birth canal and they're almost squeezed. So it almost brings up this mucus off their chest. Whereas with a cesarean, they don't have that quite as much. Even if you have a gentle cesarean where they're sort of, they're trying to mimic it, it's not quite as much. It's not going to be as squeezing as they are through the birth canal. So it can mean that babies are like sick quite a bit and they struggle to latch on because actually they try to feed and they've just got this mucus on their chest that they need to bring up and they can't quite get it. So it's uncomfortable for them to feed. So you're trying and then they start coughing up and then they start bringing up this mucus. They'll eventually do a massive vomit and it'll bring up all this mucus and then they'll usually be fine after that. So like trying to continue to offer the breast, offer some colostrum, is a good way to sort of push past that because it can sort of mean that they're just a little bit uncomfortable with it. The delay with milk supply comes from not necessarily a cesarean, but to do with a blood loss. That's very, very common because milk supply and milk is made from your blood. It's not made from your stomachs. It's not made because of you're having a vaginal birth. The trigger of milk production going from colostrum to mature milk comes from your placenta. As soon as your placenta is removed, it starts the process of changing things and starting that hormonal shift. So if your placenta is removed, then it's starting things. But what can happen with a cesarean that's a bit more likely than a vaginal birth is that you can have a bit more of a blood loss. And if you do have more of a blood loss, your milk supply is going to be a little bit lower because you're not able to make the milk supply from your blood. So that's more of a common thing to happen. That's, I think, where the idea that milk production is slower in terms of a C-section. But it doesn't always mean the case. You know, some cesareans are really calm and the blood loss is actually really, really minimal. It's only in probably the more emergency situations where it's not necessarily expected that it may cause a delay in your milk production. And again, it doesn't mean that that's it. You're not going to have milk production at all. You know, you can keep getting that skin to skin hand expressing. You can increase your milk supply and you may be offered, you know, iron transfusion, you might be offered a blood transfusion to help things. So if you have lost a big amount of blood and they may be offering to have a blood transfusion, it might be that actually you think about taking that offer because you need that blood to help your milk production. So it just, again, it helps you make those decisions because you might be feeling, actually, I feel all right now after that blood loss. but your milk supply might not be quite there. But yeah, it doesn't mean that if you have a cesarean that you're not going to be able to breastfeed at all. It's just going about it in a slightly different route and a slightly different way.
I suspect because it's more challenging because you've got multiple factors impacting the C-section, and you're also you're probably going to have syntocinon for the third stage labour with the C-section as well. So you've got multiple different drugs impacting your feeding.
Yeah.
Plus the discomfort, plus potentially pain relief drugs afterwards.
Yeah.
You get given things potentially afterwards to help you feel more comfortable after your C-section. So you've got lots of different factors at play than just one.
Yeah, it's more like they're building up to something rather than it just being the C-section on its own that causes the problem. It's more the things that come along with the cesarean that tend to be the problem.
Yeah. And how about if someone has a very straightforward vaginal unmedicated birth? Is there anything that they should be considering that is going to give them the best chance of having a better feeding experience afterwards?
Yeah, I think keeping that standard thing that I've mentioned all throughout, skin to skin contact, literally is kind of the bread and butter when it comes to feeding and getting things off to a good start. And that even means that if your baby was taken away at any point, get that skin to skin contact as soon as possible and for as long as possible, because it's kind of like a bit of a reset button for breastfeeding. So it really helps to get things going and it starts that rooting reflex. So keeping in that skin to skin contact, you can delay things like baby being weighed, baby being checked over. They can be checked over in your arms in that skin to skin contact. The only thing that they cannot physically do is that weight, but that can wait for a really decent amount of time. You know, in my last birth, we had a lovely home birth and we stayed in skin to skin contact for 2 hours because he latched on and he was just feeding for about an hour and a half. And we just delayed it until he'd come off the breast by himself. And then they said, "Do you think he's ready now?" I was like, "Yeah, I think he's ready now. I think he's all good to come and be weighed." There was no rush. There's no need to very, very quickly weigh your baby. You know, if they are taken away from you and then come back, it could just cause a little bit of a break, and that separation can delay, you know, feeding. And you know, it's one of those things that Dr. Sarah Buckley talks about quite a lot, is that hormone gap in terms of feeding. You know, if they are separated from you, it does cause that hormone gap in oxytocin. So keeping your baby close to you throughout, so if you have a very normal birth, just keeping them close to you is the best way. And I know that can be really, really difficult after a birth because you're totally shattered. Regardless of the birth that you've had, it's exhausting. But keeping them close to you as much as possible, keeping in that skin-to-skin contact, can just really help to keep things going in that direction. Mm-hmm. You know, there are things that can impact things afterwards. You know, like I said, with the postpartum hemorrhage, if you have a blood loss, it can have a knock-on effect. And really consider the syntometrin, the syntocinol injection for your placenta. If you have had a very straightforward normal birth, is there a need for the injection?
Because they'll always offer it.
Yeah. Oh, gotcha. Absolutely. Absolutely always. But like we've discussed, the syntocinol does have an impact in the baby and it can make you feel a little bit nauseous, which can mean that maybe you say, "Please take baby away. I'm feeling a little bit sick at the moment." So it's being aware of actually the risks of it and going, well, if everything's okay, if I've not got a big blood loss after birth, is there a reason that I need to have this injection? Because I've done this part of it, and actually this syntocinon can have an impact on your baby in terms of breastfeeding. So just carefully considering that as well, because it doesn't finish at the birth of your baby. There's the placenta as well.
Yeah, which lots of people,
we always forget about it.
Everyone forgets about the placenta, but it's really
important. And it's quite surprising. People are like, "There's a third stage of labour? What's that?"
Yeah, quite often when I talk about the stages of labour, people are like, "Oh,
yeah."
Because when someone talks about their birth story, it kind of finishes when the baby arrives. No one actually talks about what happened afterwards.
Yeah.
The other thing to consider with the syntometrine or the syntocinon with the third stage of labour is that there is some evidence to show that if you've had a physiological birth and you've not had any drugs, having those drugs for the third stage of labor actually increases the chances of postpartum hemorrhage rather than
doing what's the opposite.
So it's definitely worthwhile researching the effects of some of these drugs and what the research is behind them, because it's not discussed, and it won't be discussed antenatally, and it probably won't be mentioned when it's offered to you during labor.
And all it'll be done is like, oh, this is what we do to help get the placenta out and reduce bleeding. But actually, if you're not bleeding and the placenta is going to come out, you know, we have just a big, massive epidemic of people getting the injection just because it's the dumb thing. And it just surprises me that actually so many are getting this when actually we don't necessarily need it. Sometimes it is absolutely necessary. You know, if someone has had, you know, an induction, a forceps birth, and they are actively bleeding afterwards, it might be a good idea to accept it. But you're considering it all, and it's considering all the risks and benefits along with it, and actually looking at your own situation, not just what the policy tells us to do. It's looking at the whole thing as a picture, and you as an individual, rather than looking at, you know, society as a whole, because you are your own person. You're different to everybody.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I wrote my induction quick guide, because you know, it's induction on the whole and the drugs that are used, it's so complex, and a lot of the research actually is indicating the opposite of what the NICE guidelines would recommend. So it is definitely worth getting clued up before you go into labor, so you understand the impact of some of these things.
And the only other thing I wanted to very briefly mention is about instrumental birth, because particularly forceps deliveries, a baby can be quite in pain afterwards, and they can almost behave like they've got a tongue tie because they've had tension pulled on them with the forceps. So it can make their head hurt. They might be in pain to latch in certain ways because actually it hurts them a little bit. So it's knowing that that's quite normal. And I really highly recommend for anyone that's had an instrumental birth to look into cranial osteopathy for baby or chiropractor, because it is so, so beneficial to just release that tension for your baby to be able to feed a little bit better. And you can also have, you know, if you've had an instrumental birth, you're probably going to have had an episiotomy. So it can be quite uncomfortable for you to actually sit down. So leaning back when feeding, you know, doing the laid back position, can help you to just get a little bit more comfortable. But I think with instrumental birth, it is really, really common for babies to just find it to be a little bit more uncomfortable and to have that extra tension with it.
Which is unsurprising, because if you think about with a spontaneous vaginal birth, the uterus is pushing the baby out. As soon as we use instruments, we're pulling on the baby's head, which is not designed to do, as well as pushing from the other side. And that's going to put loads of tension on the neck and the shoulders and the head. So, it's unsurprising that they're going to feel uncomfortable in certain positions. I also highly recommend going to see a cranial osteopath. My first daughter, who was induced, she was quite fractious when she was first born, and she never used to sleep at all. And we took her to see a cranial osteopath, and she fell asleep while she was having the cranial osteopathy. And then she slept for 4 hours, and I thought she was dead. I was like, I kept on going up to her and going, is she still breathing? Like, why is she still asleep? But she was just so chilled. It obviously did so much good for her that she just had this mega sleep afterwards. And it's really gentle as well. You can't really see them doing anything. It almost looks like they're not doing anything. I remember them kind of just resting her head in their hands, and you couldn't even see them moving their hands, but they're just very gently manipulating all of the tissues around the neck and shoulders and back and releasing any of that tension. So that's a really, really good suggestion.
Yeah, I definitely recommend anyone that's had an instrumental birth just to get that in, because they do commonly feel quite a bit of, even if you're not breastfeeding, do it anyway, because they can have that tension. So being quite a bit of pain. So getting those few sessions in can just help to release that tension and for them to feel a bit more comfortable as well. So a lot of people do find that their babies, like you said, are quite unsettled. So doing that can just calm them down a little bit. It makes your job as a parent much easier when you've got a baby that actually settles compared to one that is screaming, crying out in pain all the time. You know, it makes a massive difference.
Is there anything else that we haven't discussed, we haven't covered? I suspect there probably is quite a long list.
Oh, there's so many things, but I think I've covered mainly all the things that I wanted to, you know, even very briefly. I sort of briefly mentioned about a pair hemorrhage and separation with your baby and stuff. And most of the things, and that, like I said, the absolute main tip is just to stay in that skin to skin. It is a common theme throughout every single problem that arises, is just be in that skin to skin and stay in that skin to skin. You can literally never do enough of skin to skin contact. And I feel like I've said those words about 100 times.
It's because it's so important.
Yeah, I feel like I say it so many times that it's almost, you know, when you said a word so often, it almost is meaningless anymore. Like it just has nothing to it. But it is just absolutely vital. It should be given almost as a prescription. If you're birthing in the hospital and they're like, right, okay, here's your discharge papers, you know, here's some a little bit of medication to take home with you, and your prescription is skin to skin all day, you know, from the hours of 9 a.m. until 9 p.m. because sometimes you might be able to do it at night quite as much, but throughout the whole day, this is your prescription. It should literally be done as that. We're not given the importance and the benefits of what skin to skin can actually do enough. You know, we talk about it a little bit, like, yeah, we'll get some skin to skin contact, but actually it is so incredibly, incredibly important. And especially when it comes to breastfeeding, it just helps dramatically when it comes to feeding. So just do it all the time. And if you feel at all worried about your birth and feeding, do some antenatal colostrum harvesting, because then you've got it kind of like ready if you need it. You also, it also means you're getting that practice during pregnancy, because it is a skill to have, you know, it takes a bit of practice to figure out, but it means that you've had a bit of practice during your pregnancy. So if anything does arise and you do need to hand express some colostrum and give it to your baby, it means that actually you're not stressed out. You're not trying to work out, well, how on earth do I even do this? You've done it before, you figured it out while you're pregnant. So it's much less stressful to do it in your pregnancy than to suddenly try and figure it all out postnatally when you've got a baby probably crying, hoping for some food, and maybe you're in pain from labor and birth and whatever happened. You know, it's knowing that you've known how to do it rather than trying to fumble around during the postnatal period. And just knowing that these things may happen, how to overcome them, and knowing that the effects of them, like I said at the beginning, it just helps you to make an informed decision. Because like I said, knowing maybe the effects of an induction, it might just help you to kind of think a bit more about it rather than just going straight along with what's recommended.
Yeah. Thank you so much for today. I think it's been really, really fascinating. I think everyone's going to find it really, really interesting and really helpful. If anybody wants to find you online, where do they find you?
So I'm at Bees Birth and Boobs on literally everything. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and I'm trying to do TikTok, but it's quite a world there in TikTok, isn't it? Not quite as much there, but I am on Instagram quite a lot. And yeah, I've got my own hypnobirthing courses in person as well. So yeah, I'm around all over the place.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Bee, for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on here. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.